ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Fran Kelly, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, it's become a running joke. You have a conversation or you Google something, suddenly your feeds are flooded with ads and offers on the very same topic. What are the chances? But what if the information being tracked and shared online is about your fertility or your choice of contraception or your mental health? This is a practice the Privacy Commissioner Carly Kind is taking on, and she's my guest in a moment. Also ahead, it's the stuff dreams are made of. Debut Tasmanian author Conrad Muller has been shortlisted for the prestigious Miles Franklin Literary Award. But in the increasingly cutthroat world of publishing, stories like his are more likely to be fiction than fact. And from cracking some of biology's toughest problems to opening new frontiers in treatment, AI is already transforming medicine, opening up a world of possibility in the lab and in frontline treatment.
What we want to ultimately do is treat the individual. And so go from saying, this is your risk of having a disease, to saying, these are the right treatments that will work for you specifically.
It's a good news AI story. One of Australia's leading biotechnologists will be my guest later in the program. Across Australia, some of the most intimate questions you can think of about fertility, prostate health, contraception, your mental health, have quietly been collected and turned into data for advertisers. Now, an investigation by the Privacy Commissioner released today has found that two leading medical companies, the telehealth provider Medmate and the fertility clinic Monash IVF, have been tracking visitors to their site through invisible code without people's consent and then fed that information about them to social media companies so they can be chased with ads. The regulator's findings are its first ruling on this technology. It's a case that cuts right to the tension between modern data-driven marketing practices and the expectation of confidentiality in sensitive areas. So how did this happen, and what does it mean for the way your medical information is handled online? Carly Kind is Australia's Privacy Commissioner. Commissioner, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks for having me, Fran.
Carly, can you walk us through what first prompted this investigation into Medmate and Monash IVF? What raised red flags for your office?
Absolutely. A couple of years ago, there were some news stories over Christmas 2024 about the TikTok pixel and the ways in which TikTok was gathering information on Australian internet users through the embedding of these invisible lines of code in websites. And that information was brought to our office, and we spent some time considering the issues. And we identified the fact that pixels are, in fact, a widespread tracking technology used by social media platforms. So not only TikTok, Meta, Google, Twitter, Pinterest, etc., all use these pixels to gather information about Australian internet users and then target them with ads. But instead of focusing our subsequent investigation on TikTok, we actually wanted to focus on the website providers themselves, because they are the ones that make the decisions to install the pixels, they configure the pixels, and they have the direct relationship with the internet users that are visiting their website. So we've been looking at what are their obligations when they're installing these invisible pieces of code on their website, which transmit data back to the social media platforms.
And these pixels, these tracking pixels, we don't know they're there. We can't see they're there. Is there consent given to have them on the sites that we're looking at? Do we have any way of knowing?
So in basically the large majority of cases, you're neither being told that tracking pixels are used on your sites, nor are you being asked for your consent. And unlike cookies, which probably we're a little bit more aware of that are use on websites, tracking pixels, most people don't really know anything about them. They've not even heard the term, but they are there in a large majority of websites that you're visiting. And in fact, you can install a tool on your browser that tells you when there are tracking pixels being used. We surveyed 50 health service provider websites, and we found that 96% of those websites used tracking pixels, And that includes pixels that were sending data back to TikTok, Snapchat, Meta, etc. So it's not really known by most of the Australian community. But having said that, most of us will be familiar with the fact that when we go on the website, we look at something on Country Road or something, and then an hour or so later, we're scrolling through Instagram and there are those shoes that we were looking at on Country Road an hour ago. We're kind of familiar with this notion that ads follow us around the internet. These tracking pixels are the technical mechanism that enable that to happen.
Yeah, and that was news to me, but not so much news, as you say, that someone somehow is tracking what I'm searching. And these tracking pixels are not illegal. As you just say, they're ubiquitous. They're pervasive. So why does that behaviour so much matter in a healthcare context on health websites compared to other parts of the internet? Because you're not going after other parts of the internet, are you?
That's right. We specifically focused on health service providers because the Privacy Act gives special protections to health data. It acknowledges that health data is a special kind of sensitive category of data. It's more important to us. It reveals a lot more intimate things about our lives, and therefore it has additional protections so that when any entity, a business, a company, a government agency is collecting our health data, they have to ask for our consent, and they're not doing that.
Okay, so they're not getting consent, so that's a breach of the law. But both the companies here, Monash IVF and Medscape, argued, I think, that this data collected was anonymised, therefore not identifiable directly, really. So it's not a breach of privacy. Is that so? And why isn't that protection enough?
So this is where the decision gets a little wonky, but indeed the question of what is personal information that's covered by the Act mm-hmm. is not a straightforward one. The Act says that personal information is any information about an individual who is reasonably identifiable. And so we really asked, what does it mean to be reasonably identifiable in today's digital era? It doesn't mean that they have to have your legal identifiability. They don't have to have your driver's license or your car rego. But they have enough information to be able to distinguish you from other people and affect your rights and interests. So if they can target you
as a user, they can target you for a specific ad rather than me
correct.
For the ad.
Correct, exactly. So they can do something called individuation. They can single you out and then they can bombard you with targeted advertising. And my decision is that that is enough to amount to identifiability in today's digital era. That is sufficient to allow the Privacy Act to kick in and afford its protection.
So just to be clear here, Carly, Is it the consent that matters most to you as the Privacy Commissioner and ongoing, sort of universally, or the type of information that's being collected and pinpointed here?
I think there's a few things that matter here. Consent is really important when it is this category of sensitive personal information. But our decision also focuses more broadly on notification. People need to be able to be told and understand that this kind of data collection is happening. And that's true whether or not it's sensitive information or just general personal information. We also made findings that there wasn't appropriate notification that these tools are in use. And that's something that we'd like to see more broadly taken away from the decision. In fact, people feel that it's an invasion of their privacy to have their data constantly collected in this way. And they need to have more knowledge and then more choice and control ultimately about when their data is being collected.
And didn't you just tell us though that it is illegal not to identify that and ask for consent? Why were the companies doing that? Why did they think they could get away with that?
I think to be fair to the companies, and they did really participate in good faith, there hasn't been decisions that have set this out in detail as applicable in this particular space. The technologies have raced ahead. It's not the case that there had been a clear decision on this previously that the companies were contravening, so much as the technology has changed and we need to update our understandings of what the law requires.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is Australia's Privacy Commissioner, Carly Kind, who's issued a major ruling today that found that a couple of health providers have been collecting and sharing patients' sensitive data through tracking technologies that are invisible and without gaining consent. You've singled out these two companies on the basis that it's the type of information is sensitive, but are you worried about this more broadly than the fact that someone's privacy has been interrupted or has been ignored, breached in this case? What's the longer term impact here that you're worried about, and how much did that influence your decision in this case or your ruling?
I think in the context of health data, particularly Fran, we think there's a lot of societal value in people feeling that they can go to the internet to get access to health services, get access to health information. Obviously, we want people to be seeking out mental health services, for example, or access to parental services, all of these kinds of things that are covered by health services. And our concern is that if people are being monitored and surveilled in this way, they will be less likely to do that because there's a chilling effect. We might self-censor if we feel that our web browsing data is being tracked in this way. So we think that stronger privacy protections here will in fact support people's use of the digital economy and digital services and make them more likely to seek out the information that can be of real assistance to them and to their family. I think more broadly, we'd like to see people generally feeling like they can browse the internet and use digital technologies without having to hand over their data at every turn, to feel more empowered and more in control. And unfortunately, this kind of extractive data collection is the business model of online services currently. And most Australians feel very out of control and like it's almost like too hard to put the genie back in the bottle for them. As the privacy regulator, I'm doing my best bit by bit to try to stem that where I can. And this is, I think, a really important part of that.
No fines have been imposed on these companies. Could you have chosen to impose a fine and why didn't you?
We could have. We have the ability to pursue civil penalties proceedings. The two reasons why we chose not to in this case, the first is that civil penalties proceedings generally take a number of years, whereas by issuing a determination, we can get pretty immediate outcomes for the Australian community in terms of these two particular providers. We've declared that they need to cease these activities immediately. But secondly, also because we acknowledge that this is a novel issue and one in which we haven't provided a lot of jurisprudence to date. And so we think that the entities are entitled to that benefit of the doubt in a way. Certainly going forward, if we continue to get concerns in this space, we'll consider civil penalty action.
So the companies need to cease these activities immediately. Is that it? What about all the data they've collected so far? What about the data that's been passed on to social media companies that can never be taken back, I presume?
That's right. So they need to cease collecting the data and need to the extent that they can, destroy all sensitive information, including data that's being held in those social media platforms. They need to take steps to delete that.
And what steps will you take to ensure that they do?
There's a range of different ways in which we can ensure compliance with our determinations, but essentially we'll be asking them to provide evidence that they've complied with those declarations within 60 days of our decision.
And is this just an Australian issue? Presumably we have seen similar behaviour in the US and other places. What's the international experience tell us about how systemic this problem has become and who's dealt with it most effectively?
Indeed. And in fact, we were inspired in our early months of our investigation by a similar investigation that the FTC undertook in the US against a pharmaceutical provider. In the EU, where they have a comprehensive privacy law, there are in fact a range of technical standards that entities use to ensure that they are getting consent where consent's required. But it has to be said that in large parts, the internet is still a wild west and privacy regulators around the world are a little bit playing a game of whack-a-mole, unfortunately, particularly with certain providers. So it's not the case that Australia is the only country in which this is a problem.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is Australia's Privacy Commissioner, Carly Kind, and we're talking about her ruling today that two significant medical companies have been found in breach of privacy of visitors' their websites by using third-party tracking devices called tracking pixels without consent. As we've discussed, the key concern here, or one of the key concerns, was this was happening without people giving consent. Is there a risk, though, that the companies identified and others now in the wake of this ruling just stick some kind of generic but very difficult to understand waiver in the fine print that you have to click on when you visit the site and just keep doing this?
I think that is a risk, Fran, to be completely honest. I mean, that's what we've seen happen in other jurisdictions. There is certainly the risk that the regulated community don't implement this finding in good faith, but in fact make it more annoying, more painful for people to use their sites rather than less.
Is there anything you can do about that?
Certainly we've been provided guidance as to what we think good looks like when it comes to getting consent in the right ways, but I won't be able to prevent those bad intentioned implementations either.
And do you have any advice for us? Are there any practical ways that someone can ensure that they aren't being tracked by these pixel trackers?
Yeah, in the report we've published today as well, we've also got a section there about what steps individuals can take to regain control. As I said, there's some free online tools you can access and install on your browser to be able to see when tracking technologies are in use. There's tools like Brave, for example, Ghostry, things that can help your browser prevent the use of tracking technologies wherever possible and block them as well. And you can also go into social media platforms and have a look at the data that they have about you and make a lot of decisions actually about what you will and won't let them collect. So you can go into Facebook, for example. You can go to somewhere called Off Facebook Activity, which has all the information that other organizations have shared with Meta about you. So you can really start to understand a little more about what are these social media platforms collecting on me? Mm. Where's it coming from? And what kind of profile are they building up about me and my life?
And as you say, it comes back to perhaps the bigger question of the Wild West that is internet advertising. I mean, the business model of the internet is that, is advertising. Is there a fundamental tension between targeted advertising and the handling of sensitive data, in this case, health information? And who gets to draw the line between what's too sensitive to track and what's not?
Yeah, great question, Fran. I think there is a fundamental tension there. And 10 years ago, Shoshana Zuboff wrote a book called Surveillance Capitalism, which really spelled out that we are looking at an internet that is heavily based in a business model that is quite extractive and privacy interfering. And I think that that is a real challenge. The good news is that, you know, laws are improving and in fact, technologies are improving to allow users to have more privacy preserving approaches to using their tools. And, you know, your listeners will be familiar with the fact that a few years ago, Apple turned on the Do Not Track feature on their apps, which makes it really simple with one click of a button to prevent the use of tracking technologies on apps, for example. So the technology can improve things, law can improve things, regulators can improve things. But it is still the case that in the current iteration of the web, we have a pretty privacy unfriendly business model. And that's why we see moves to subscription based approaches, for example, as a potential alternative that doesn't result in the mass extraction of personal data and gives people more power and choice and control. And I think that's a positive thing.
Carly Khan, thank you very much for joining us and taking the time to explain all this to us. Thank you.
Thanks, Fran.
Carly Kind is Australia's Privacy Commissioner, and that report we mentioned is called Your Life Pixelated, How Tracking Pixels Watch Your Every Click. It's available now on the website of the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, and as Carly outlined for us, we can do something about it. We can improve things too, and if you want to find out more and find out some of those tips for how you can block these tracking mechanisms, the address is oaic.gov.au. You're listening to the Radio National Hour.
The Radio National Hour with Fran Kelly.
Is there anything more satisfying than spending an afternoon browsing your local bookshop, dipping into new releases, choosing the next title to add to that stack next to your bedside table, or maybe picking out a gift for a loved one? But these days, visiting a bookshop can be a pretty overwhelming experience because there's simply too much to choose from. Increasingly tight margins for publishers mean that they are rushing their publishing schedules and flooding the market with new titles in a bid to recover their costs. That's one version of what's going on in the industry anyway. Some authors say that these pressures are making it more and more difficult to get their work published and that they're being forced to sacrifice quality to get their work onto shelves quickly. Conrad Muller is the author of My Heart at Evening, and his debut novel has been published by Tasmanian micropress Evercreech Editions, and this morning he was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award. And Alice Grundy is editor of the Australia Institute Press. She's a longtime commentator and contributor on the Australian publishing industry. Conrad and Alice, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you, Fran.
Thanks for having me.
And Conrad, congratulations on being shortlisted for the Miles Franklin. How did that feel?
Yeah, pretty mind-blowing, to be honest, Fran, for a couple of reasons. I mean, it's my debut novel, but also, as you mentioned in the lead-in, it's the first release from a new micropress out of Tasmania. So for such a book to go so far is really, really quite surprising and fantastic.
Let's talk about that journey a little, because I understand it was quite a long road to get your book published and onto shelves. You finished writing the novel in 2022. So tell me a little about that journey.
Well, the book was finished in 22. I wrote the book in the first half of 22. The actual composition was quite quick. And then there was just the usual process of attempting to sell the book. I didn't have an agent at that stage. I had some contacts in the publishing industry from previous attempts to try and publish works of fiction without success. And so I went to four of the larger publishing houses in Australia who knocked the book back. At that point, I then was sort of scouting around for agents. And an agent in London took the book on, somebody called Charles Walker, when a friend of mine, Adam Alston, himself a Miles Franklin listed novelist, for a book he wrote back in 22 called, it was published in 22, it was called Waypoints. And Adam, I guess he himself was motivated by some of the frustrations about the state of the industry that you've alluded to. He decided that, you know, the thing to do was to set up a micro press to see if he could assist, you know, good fiction that was not seeing the light of day. He knew my manuscript and asked if they could consider it. It hadn't been sold in London at that point in time. So I said yes, of course, please, because I'd had the experience before of manuscripts not going anywhere. So, I mean, that's the story from the completion of the writing of the book to signing with Evercreech. That okay. was about an 18-month period.
And the Sydney Morning Herald, I noticed when they were announcing the shortlist today, say your debut novel was, quote, plucked from obscurity. So once the book got published and got to the bookshelves, did it sell?
It was well received critically. And in fact, we sort of embarked upon a sort of process of many events across the country at small independent bookshops. We probably did about 14 events mm-hmm. from the launch of the book in August of last year through until last month when I did one at Imprints at Adelaide, and trying to build a readership. And so as a result of critical reception and just sort of getting on the road and selling the book, building a readership, we went through two print runs before the book was longlisted for the Miles Franklin in May. So we'd sold. It doesn't sound like a large number, but we sold 1,000 books by that stage. So, you know, I think we'd done reasonably well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, on the margins, definitely on the margins of the literary scene.
Well,
yeah.
You're there on the shortlist, so I wouldn't worry any further. Conrad Muller is my guest. He's an author and also Alice Grundy, who's the editor of the Australia Institute Press. We're talking about the state of the Australian publishing industry. Alice, Conrad's story, you know, it's gone pretty well for him, but it's not the norm, is it? I mean, a lot of authors have quite a different experience in getting their book to market where when they are part of one of our bigger publishing houses, as I understand it.
Yes, there's a really big range in terms of how long it takes for a book to be signed, for it to reach the public. But one of the interesting stories from last year was the so-called mushroom trial. And it was in very quick succession after that trial was announced that three publishers announced their books on that subject. And they had to be written and published in a few short months. And just to give you an idea, it takes minimum 2 weeks to print a book. So that means you have to get all of the other things like design, editing, and legaling, importantly, done in a very short period.
And so what does that tell us? That it can be done, but that's guaranteed an audience, really, isn't it? A book about the mushroom trial, in this case, you know, such a highly, highly listened to, thought about, known, and intrigued by true crime.
Yes, the publishers were doing it on purpose. They were getting ready for the biggest book-selling season of the year, which is Christmas, and so they were confident there were lots of people interested in this, and they knew that people would be buying their friends and relatives these books for Christmas. But the concern is what happens, you know, what gets lost if the usual timelines of book publishing are collapsed like that.
Okay, well, let's talk about that, what gets lost. If there is so much rush and push to get books out, which is what authors are saying, is there a disconnect here? What is making it so challenging for writers to sell their books, to get their books into people's hands? I mean, they're on the shelves for all to see, and yet they're reporting that the production timelines are very, very rushed, and that means they're not getting proper editing, they're not getting proper assistance with not just copy editing, but storyline editing, things like that.
Mm. The way that publishing generally works is publishers don't have a crystal ball. They don't know which book is going to be a massive bestseller. So they publish quite a few books in a hope that at least a few of them will be successful. But the issue with that means that in terms of dedicating resources to these projects, it's not always clear how the resourcing should be distributed. It's sometimes they need books at certain times of the year. I mentioned Christmas, but Mother's Day and Father's Day are also very important sales periods. So sometimes books are rushed just to meet a particular sales period. And if the point is just having a book in a given slot, then that means the timeline is more important in some cases than making sure the book has its due care.
Is volume, though, how publishers stay afloat, to the detriment of writers? Is that what authors are reporting?
It seems like volume is one issue, and that has implications all the way down the line. So let's say a publicist is responsible for 6 books in a given month. It's very difficult for them to give each of those 6 books the same amount of attention. And in book publishing in Australia, generally marketing budgets are incredibly low. Conrad mentioned going on a tour, but most authors don't get to go on a national tour for their book. So the promotion for Australian books tends to be fairly limited. And it's the major best-selling authors who enjoy those aspects of the publishing and then have a better chance of meeting readers.
And is anything changing here? I mean, as you say, no publisher is going to know absolutely what's going to be a hit. So the scattergun approach is basically built into the industry. But is it worse now, and why? Is it normal for the publishers to have 6 books a month, for instance, since authors? Are publicity budgets smaller? In-house staff, is there fewer of them?
One of the big issues for publishing staff is their pay rates. Pay rates in publishing are very low, which means that people, you know, publicists, for example, have to read all of those books. They often have to tour with authors. They're working outside of business hours. So the kinds of expectations on staff are very high. But the other concern in terms of volume is, you know, the author will spend oftentimes a few years working on their book, and then it usually only has a window of 3 to 6 months to make an impact in booksellers. In Australia, we have a sale or return model. So if the book doesn't sell within 3 months, the bookseller can return it to the publisher free of charge.
And then what happens to it?
Well, it depends. Oftentimes that leads to pulping, which is something people don't really like to talk about. But if publishers produce too many copies of a book and they know that warehousing books is expensive, then one of the things that publishers sometimes do is send the books to be turned into pulp.
It's brutal, isn't it, when you've spent so long writing the book. Conrad, this sounds like it wasn't your experience. You've talked about the book tours. You've talked about going with the micro press. But I'm guessing you've been talking to other writers over the last year or two. How's their experiences been? How have they recounted their experiences to you?
Most of the people I know, they don't tend to sort of complain too much about the circumstances of the market that they operate in. They accept it as a reality and they try to make it work as well as they possibly can. It's true to say, from my knowledge of literature, that the history of literature, that selling books has never, particularly works of literary fiction, it's never been easy. I mean, I think of the case of James Joyce, for example, Dubliners, possibly the best collection of short stories in the English language, 600 copies published by him, self-published. And he went out and sold those to bookshops in Dublin. They didn't move. He hit the street and he started to buy them himself so he could create the illusion of a market demand, or at least that's the story that I've heard. Perhaps that's an exaggeration. But the point I suppose I'm making is that I don't think it's ever been an easy space to operate in.
I love that story. Alice, is the bigger problem that if it is rushed, this whole scattergun publishing process, that authors aren't getting the scrutiny, if you like, and the support they need, and therefore we're not getting the best literary product we could have in Australia, that the quality of new Australian literature in this market at this time is diminishing if it's all about the volume?
Well, as Conrad says, in book publishing, there's always been stories about rushed timelines, about authors not being happy with their editors, about pressures from the market and from the critical sphere. I think the difficulty now is just that there is so much being published, both from trade publishers and from self-publishers. It's hard for authors to get their work into the hands of publishers, but it's hard for readers to know what's good. It's hard for them to see the best of Australian writing because there's so much noise.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest, Conrad Muller, who's the author of My Heart at Evening, which has just been shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award, and Alice Grundy. Alice is the editor of Australia Institute Press. Alice, can you talk to me about self-publishing? Is that happening more as we've got the technology sort of in our easy reach?
Yes, it certainly is. There's been a drastic increase in self-publishing. It's difficult to get some of the stats on this. A lot of people are self-publishing directly through Amazon, and they are famously protective and secretive about their data. One of the ways that we can tell that there's been an increase in self-publishing, though, is the number of ISBNs. So that's the little number below the barcode, mm-hmm. the number of ISBNs that are being sold in Australia, and that number has increased drastically.
And can I just stay with this economic model for a little while longer, talk about the money? Because I mentioned in the introduction that the margins were small for publishers. How small are we talking? For a start, what's gone up in price and what hasn't gone up in price? What are the sort of, what's the sums here?
Well, paper has gone up a huge amount in price, and obviously books are made of paper. But people might say, what about ebooks? Well, ebooks have almost all of the costs of a traditional book, except for the printing and the delivery from one location to another. You still have to pay the author. You still have to pay the distributor, the editor, the designer. If it's being legaled, you have to pay your lawyers as well, which is never a small cost. And so in each case, the margins are really being pressured because, like all other industries, the cost of living has gone up. In every area, these costs are increasing. And if you're an author, you're getting 10% of the retail price, which means, say, $3.50 per book. A publisher might be expecting roughly the same for a book that sells through a bookshop. But if it's a really small press, they have to pay higher distribution fees because it goes through multiple pairs of hands. And they don't enjoy the benefits of a lower unit cost from a higher print run. So smaller publishers have a harder time making a profit on the books that they publish.
So to put a figure around this so we can understand it, on a standard print run in Australia, how does it work? How much would the author and the publisher earn?
Well, let's say an author, their print run is about 1,500 copies and they're getting $3.50 per copy. It's only a few thousand dollars. And that's really not that much money if you're thinking about a few years' work. In terms of the editor, if it's a freelancer, they might get roughly the same amount of money. But in Australia, editorial pay rates for a senior editor, for example, that has been set. There's an award wage for that. And a senior editor in Australia is likely to earn below the average wage, despite being likely to have postgraduate qualifications, to have worked in the industry for the better part of a decade, to have all of that professional experience. So while the authors are on vanishingly low pay rates, editors are also poorly paid.
And the publisher, how much does the publisher come out with in an average book?
Well, this is a piece of string question, but okay. on a small print run, a publisher is likely to, if they're lucky, break even, but more likely to come out in the red. It's very, very hard for publishers to make money on books. And so what they might hope, you know, the great thing about a prize like the Miles Franklin is getting a big boost in sales. And even a 5,000 copy book is enough to set a publisher up to experiment with a few more books and maybe have some more shots at success. But if they publish a few books that are only in the 1,000, 1,500 copy range, then really they need a benefactor to operate because it's very hard to make a profit at that level.
Does this all sound right to you, Conrad?
Yeah, I mean, it does really. I think that in the case of Evercreech, there's a lot of people making contributions that are not strictly driven by the logic of rational economics. And that explains why it's been able to happen. People are making commitments of time that don't make any sense in financial terms. Can I just sort of second one remark of Alice's, which I think is really important, and that is just this question of independent bookshops in Australia. Just from my experience, they've really been the sort of bedrock of what we've attempted to do to try and reach readers. It's been through those bookshops like the paperback in Melbourne, Imprints in Adelaide, Avid Reader in Brisbane, abbeys in Sydney, that has made it possible for us to have events and find readers.
And Alice, what about small independent publishers? Because yes, some have been taken over by some of the big publishing houses, but there's also been a small number come out in recent times too, which is, you know, surprising really. Would you expect that the small publishers that have arisen in the last year, I think there's, I read an article that said there were five of them, I think, will the model be that they then get subsumed into the bigger publishing houses over time? Is that the pipeline from quality, if you like, to quantity?
That might be of interest to some people, but we've also seen independent publishers in Australia choose to remain independent. The other thing that can happen is they can simply fold. A lot of the labour that goes into book publishing, especially in small, even micro publishing houses, it's volunteer work effectively. And once the people who have created the organisation are no longer associated with it, or if there are other pressures in their life, then they simply can't do that work for free anymore. So while some may well go on to be merged with larger companies, I imagine a number of them will simply cease to exist.
And Conrad, you are now a shortlisted author for the Miles Franklin Award. You are likely going to have more choice with your next book. Would you choose a micro publisher again, or would you try and go with a big publishing house?
I mean, my experience with Evercreech has been that the quality of the editing and the degree of care that was devoted to the book was exemplary. I have no prior experience of an editorial book production process in the Australian publishing industry, so I've got nothing to compare it with. But it did feel to me as though it was first rate. Yeah, for me the primary concern is the quality of production.
Alice and Conrad, thank you very much, both of you, for joining me. And again, Conrad, congratulations on making the shortlist.
Thanks very much, Fran. Thanks, Alice.
Thank you.
That's Alice Grundy. She's an editor at the Australian Institute Press and scholar of the Australian publishing industry. And Conrad Muller is the author of My Heart at Evening, which is published by the new Tasmanian micro press Evercreech Editions, and today has been announced as being shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. Here on the Radio National Hour, we've been talking a lot lately about the pitfalls and problems caused by artificial intelligence, from how we tax it, the massive amounts of energy it requires, to how worried we should be about AI taking our jobs or wreaking havoc in the hands of hackers. But AI has also been part of some of the most dramatic discoveries of recent times. It was what helped two scientists from Google DeepMind win a Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 2024, solving a 50-year scientific conundrum around how we can predict and model proteins, one of the fundamental building blocks of life. The AlphaFold discovery has almost completely changed what scientists thought was possible in understanding biology at the molecular level, turning what was once years of painstaking lab work into something that can now be done in hours. And this technology is being used in labs, in hospitals, and increasingly in the search for new treatments, including the holy grail of precision medicine, where therapies can be designed to target diseases far more accurately, potentially down to the level of the individual patient. David Asher is Professor of Biotechnology at the University of Queensland, and he's at the forefront of this work, applying these insights to understand disease and improve diagnosis. David, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you so much, Fran. It's lovely to be here.
David, when the world first sort of heard of AlphaFold, it was described as a breakthrough moment in medicine. Can you help me understand what exactly AlphaFold did that scientists hadn't been able to do before?
Absolutely. So if you look within the cell, the machines that really drive life are molecules called proteins. And if you think about common day objects in your life, a knife looks different from a fork, a car looks different from a house, and they look different because they have to perform different functions. It's the same for the proteins within your cell. They all look different because they have different functions that they need to do. And by understanding what they look like, it gives us insight into what functions that they're doing, what's going wrong in diseases, or how we can even target them and treat them in those diseases. And so what AlphaFold did was it provided a framework. Rather than spending years trying to experimentally solve a structure, it can now model any protein across the entire Earth protein universe and give us an insight into what it looks like. So you have scaffolding proteins that act like railway tracks that go from one end of your cell to the other, and they've other proteins that act like little trains that will carry cargo around and move them around your cell or around your body. And if you think about these machines, they're absolutely microscopic. We can't even see them under a microscope, but they can move cargo down the entire length of a neuron, which can stretch from your brain all the way down your spine. So it's actually unfathomable distances that they're having to work. We have other proteins that act like garbage disposal trucks that go around chewing up waste. And so it's this very interconnected network of little machines all working together. And so by looking at those proteins, their shape gives us an insight into what those functions are, how they're moving, what might bind to them, what we could design that might bind to them. And so all of these little bits and pieces of information really revolutionise our understanding of the cell and life itself.
Well, let's talk about that. Since AlphaFold first emerged, you know, when there was this huge amount of excitement, in your view, what has it actually delivered so far? Is there something tangible we can point to?
So the biggest thing that AlphaFold has really delivered has been a molecular map of the protein universe. So the AlphaFold scientists and other scientists around the world have been working really hard to model what we think every single protein will looks like. The big step for us now is taking that information and actually leveraging it in real world treatments. And so there's a number of situations where that's already playing a role today. So we're already seeing these AlphaFold-enabled technologies being moved into clinical diagnosis. So as an example, we've been using protein structural information for decades to try and understand how mutations lead to disease. Now that we can model these proteins in mass and at a really fast speed, we're now moving these methodologies into the clinic where we can sequence an entire human genome and go through it and work out, hey, which mutations we might find across that genome might be leading to a disease or might put someone at risk of a different disease or a cancer. And there was a really nice example that came out of Sydney when they designed a RNA vaccine to help treat Rosie the dog. And that was really driven by AI-based technologies. Rapid DNA sequencing, then combined with AlphaFold modelling and other generative AI approaches, enabled the rational design of a vaccine, which helped prolong Rosie's life. We've used that approach in humans. And so the first AlphaFold-enabled vaccines have already come onto the market. So there was one that came out of South Korea in 2022 to treat coronavirus. There was a really nice example in Cambridge earlier this year for a universal coronavirus vaccine, which has just entered clinical trials. And there's another one that came out recently using AlphaFold to design new influenza vaccines that hopefully will have a much broader range of protection than the current vaccines, which is also entering clinical trials shortly. My prediction is some of these vaccine-based treatments are probably, some of them are already in the market, and some of them are probably within the next 5 years we'll really see them starting to proliferate. The other side of medical treatment is, of course, with the small molecule treatment, so your standard drugs that you would normally take as a pill. The first drugs that we're seeing that have been developed using AlphaFold-enabled structures have just started entering clinical trials now. And so we're probably about 5 to 10 years away from really seeing those enter the market in a strong way. But I think it's worth remembering that AlphaFold is a way for us to visualize the target molecule that we're trying to hit with these drugs. But it doesn't necessarily speed up the downstream processes. It doesn't tell us whether that drug is safe, whether it's going to work in the body, whether it's going to get to the right place in the body, how stable it is in the body. And so while we're speeding up a lot of the upstream biology, and AlphaFold has absolutely accelerated thousands of research projects around the world, it still requires really careful experimentation to make sure that before we put a molecule into humans, it is going to be safe and it's going to be doing what we want it to do. And we're not quite there yet where AI can completely replace all of that downstream experimentation side of things.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is Professor David Asher, talking about the AlphaFold breakthrough and how AI is reshaping our understanding of biology and our application and producing what many believe is or will be a revolution in terms of medicine. So you talked about the upstream processes. But let's take another real-world example. You've mentioned vaccines, for instance, and pills. In terms of treating cancer or genetic diseases, how will this technology actually change the treatment a patient receives, or at least the options and the opportunity for a patient?
What we're seeing immediately now is that our ability to diagnose patients has already been improved by our ability to model what we think these mutations are going to have as an impact on the protein's function. And so we're already seeing a stream of methods from my group and around the world improving our ability to accurately diagnose patients' risks based upon how these mutations are affecting protein structure. The next step from there is really getting towards precision medicine, where what we want to ultimately do is treat the individual. And so go from saying, this is your risk of having a disease, to saying, not just this is your risk, but these are the right treatments that will work for you specifically. And those sorts of methods are probably coming over the next 5 years. We're not quite there yet, but we are seeing some of that really take place in the mRNA vaccine fields to treat cancers, where we can sequence a cancer, we can work out what mutations exist in it, and design an mRNA vaccine that will specifically target those cancer cells. And that was a really nice example with Rosie the dog, where we could show that you can go from a genomic sequence of a cancer cell through to an mRNA vaccine very quickly. But there's still a whole heap of regulatory processes that slow down that work for humans at the moment.
So in terms of, let's leave the regulatory slowdown for a minute, but in terms of, you know, sequencing the cancer, what protein exists there, target vaccines, but what about in the case of cancer, other kind of treatments? What is it going to individualize trials for people, or, you know, is it really literally that we will have a process for treatment of, you know, my cancer versus your cancer versus the person down the street's cancer? And will that mean we're not going to be using wide spectrum chemotherapy or more basic, if you like, treatments like radiation therapy?
I don't see this approach doing away with traditional treatment strategies entirely. I would say it will accentuate them and hopefully give us more tailored approaches so we know what will work when. But it won't necessarily negate the need for surgery or your broad spectrum chemotherapy treatments. But the hope is that across all of the cancers, we can slowly develop more targeted treatments that will work in more people.
And this is what people are experiencing now when they say, I'm on a trial.
Exactly.
So are we actually now starting to see people actually being treated with some of the drugs or treatments produced by AlphaFold that flow from these trials?
In terms of vaccines, absolutely. There are vaccines in the market now that have been designed with the aid of AlphaFold, with small molecule-based drugs, so your Panadols and those sorts of molecules. They have just entered clinical trials, so they're still at the very early stages of human use, but they are already starting to be used in humans now.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is Professor of Biotechnology at Queensland Uni, David Asher, talking about AlphaFold, which was awarded a Nobel Prize back in 2024 for its breakthrough AI technology around protein science, and whether this AI-enabled technology could unlock new, more precise treatments in the years ahead. So, David, you've given us the example of Rosie the dog, and at the moment, a lot of testing happens either in test tubes or on animals. But there is a move to try and shift away from animal testing in particular. This may be where the regulatory regime comes in, but would this offer a new way of testing and modelling the way these drugs would work? How do you see that happening?
Recently, the FDA moved towards prioritising non-animal model testing for new therapeutics coming onto the market. And I think it was a really positive step by the FDA. AlphaFold itself doesn't give us the insights into where these drugs are going to necessarily be toxic or cause problems when they're administered to a human. And so what we need is new methodologies to try and work out how these drugs are going to work in humans. One of the methods that we developed in Australia is for predicting, so using AI to predict the toxicity and what happens to a drug when it enters the human body. And this is often used as a pre-screening approach before animal models or other non-animal model testing is done to try and minimize the risk of toxicity and off-target effects. What I see happening over probably the next 5 years is that the technologies that AlphaFold has enabled is eventually going to enable us to expand these models into a much more comprehensive and individualized approach. AlphaFold 3, which was released a few years ago, and related methods such as Boltz, have given us the ability to model these proteins in combination with the other partners that they interact with inside the cell, whether that's other proteins, small molecules, DNA or RNA. And so what we're trying to do now is we're trying to build up an encyclopedia of all of these structures and how these different components are all interacting together. And where I see this going in the next 5 years is trying to ultimately design a cell that we can model within a computer, and so that we can actually see how administering a type of drug or changing different environmental stimulants can affect what's happening in that cell or an organ or ultimately an entire digital twin of a person. And I think that would be the gold standard that we'd love to get to, where we can model individual treatments in a computer to work out how these particular treatments are going to work on this particular patient.
So if we got to the point where we could build a digital twin, so to speak, human-level models, would that mean we can see how this medicine is going to work, where it travels, where it moves, how quickly it operates, what it interacts with, what it's toxic to? It allows all of that in the image of a single person. So if it was me, you'd be looking effectively at a digital model of me and working out how my metabolism interacts with this medicine.
That's exactly right. And that's probably 5 to 10 years away, and the computing power will really need to expand dramatically for us to be able to model that. But that's where we're slowly heading at the moment.
David, is this a particularly exciting time to be a scientist?
Exciting and scary at the same time. I remember when AlphaFold first came out, so my group had been developing AI models for a decade to try and really map out how mutations affect protein structure and how we could use that in the clinic. And then one day we had to do all of our modelling manually, and the next day we had models of every human protein already in existence, and it was all of a sudden, wow, what can we do with this? What are they going to do next? How can we best complement what's going on in the world? I think the potential is enormous, but there's also risks associated with that. AI itself has enabled so many new avenues, but it has to be applied in the right way, and it has to be developed in the right way. And there have been a lot of failed attempts to develop methodologies in this space where people don't validate their methods appropriately. They use the wrong data to validate it. There's bias issues, and that can affect overall confidence as well. So every AI model will have a degree of bias in it, and they can have real world impacts. And so we need to make sure that the models that we're developing are applicable to everyone, not just Caucasian white male professors based in the UK.
And how hopeful can we be? Are we looking at a cancer-free, genetic disease-free future?
I think disease will always exist in some form. Viruses, bacteria are designed to evolve to escape our treatments. And so there'll always be something that will emerge, but our ability to treat what emerges will improve. And so I'm hopeful that in the future, we won't necessarily have removed all disease, but we'll have limited its impact on our lives so that we can live better and healthier lives.
David Asher, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Fran.
David Asher is Professor of Biotechnology at Queensland University. And that's it from me for today. Thank you again for your company. I hope you can join me tomorrow when I'm speaking with Hani Farid. Hani is a deep fake detective who works to try and discern real images from those that are AI generated. After 20 years of expertise in the business, he says even he's struggling to tell the difference these days. It's a frightening warning about the power of AI. Until then, have a lovely evening. Good night.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.